Welcome back to Ghosts of Arlington, and thank you for joining me for episode 50, Project Gemini, part 2.
Yes, sir, reading you loud and clear. The clock has started.
Five, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Not only did I survive my week on the Appalachian Trail with a large group of boys, but everyone else did as well. We brought back as many boys as we brought down, so that's always a good thing. It was wonderful getting to hang out with friend of the podcast, Grandpa Dave, who flew in from out west to help with the boys, and to friend of the show Jake A. for talking up the show to a few of the other adults heading out with us. I appreciate any and all help spreading the word about Ghosts of Arlington to potential listeners. In the last episode, we introduced the next 9 astronauts who joined the Mercury 7 at NASA for the upcoming programs intended to put an American on the moon. Hopefully, before a Russian got there. But while the American space program was pressing forward, so was the Soviets program, and they accomplished a few more firsts in 1962 and 1963. The two biggest accomplishments were to have 2 cosmonauts in space at the same time when the single passenger Vostok 3 was put into orbit, followed by its counterpart, Vostok 4, the next day. They also put the first woman, Valentina Tereshkova, into orbit, but rushed her training so that they could achieve that feat before the Americans. But, as you may recall, I also mentioned that the first American woman wouldn't get to space until 1983, when Sally Ride was part of a shuttle mission. So why did the Soviets think the Americans were on the verge of putting a woman in space in 1963? I'm glad you asked. NASA never did consider allowing women to join the early space program, but it wasn't due to sexism. Given the very specific skill set that the experimental program would require, only allowing experienced test pilots to apply was the right choice, and in the late 1950s and early 1960s, there were no women in the United States with high-performance test pilot experience. Okay, that last part, that was due to sexism. Russia did catch wind of the Mercury 13, a group apart from the Mercury 7, that did lead them to believe that American women would play a prominent role in Project Mercury. After the Mercury 7 were selected, Randy Lovelace, a former flight surgeon and future chair of the NASA Special Advisory Committee on Life Sciences, the man who developed NASA's screening tests for potential astronaut candidates, was curious to see how women would fare taking the same tests. In 1960, Lovelace and another flight surgeon, Air Force Brigadier General Don Flickinger, secured funding for the tests through world-renowned aviator Jacqueline Cochran, the wartime head of the Women Air Force Service Pilots, or WASPs, during World War II, and invited 19 women to take the tests. Much like their male counterparts, the women invited to participate were all experienced pilots with at least 1,000 flight hours each, but unlike the men, these women were not tested in a single group, going through the ordeal alone or at most with one other candidate. Because the doctors were just assuming the conditions humans might encounter in space, they had to guess at what tests might be required. Some of the exams were fairly typical and included x-rays and standard physicals, but some were fairly odd. For instance, one of the exams saw the women swallow a rubber tube to test the level of their stomach acid. Doctors tested reflexes and ulnar nerves, administering electric shocks to the candidates. To induce vertigo, ice water was shot into their ears, freezing the inner ear so doctors could time how quickly they recovered. To test their respiration, the women rode specially weighted exercise bikes until exhaustion set in. In all, 13 women, the so-called Mercury 13, passed the same Phase 1 physical examinations as their male counterparts. Of these, Jane Hart, already a mother of 8, was the oldest at 41, and Mary Wallace Wally Funk was the youngest at 23. Three of the 13, prominent pilot Geraldine Jerry Cobb, private and later commercial pilot Rhea Hurley, and young Wally Funk, a civilian flight instructor for U.S. Army pilots, were sent to Oklahoma City for Phase 2 training. These tests included isolation chamber testing and psychological evaluations. Other members of the Mercury 13 were also selected for Phase 2 training but were not able to get time off from their full-time jobs and thus were not able to attend. Jerry Cobb completed Phase 3 training of these advanced aeronautical examinations using military equipment and jet aircraft, and all three were slated to go to the Naval School of Aviation Medicine in Florida so the others could also complete Phase 3, and then all three could move on to more tests. But just days before reporting, the program was canceled. Without an official NASA request to run these tests, the Navy declined to cover the costs or to allow their facilities to be used for the unofficial project. At the time of the cancellation, Cobb ranked in the top 2% of testing for astronauts of both genders. After the program was canceled, Funk took and passed most of the Phase 3 tests on her own, but never had the chance to do so as part of a specific program. After the program was killed, Jerry Cobb and Janie Hart, another of the Mercury 13 who had passed Phase 1 testing, traveled to Washington, D.C. to petition the Kennedy administration to continue the program. The two met with Vice President Johnson, who seemed supportive, but in the end, the fact that none of the women were test pilots led to the project remaining dead. It was not until 1972 that an amendment to Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 finally granted women legal assistance for entering space. By 1978, the jet fighter pilot requirement was no longer an obstacle for women candidates, which was the same year NASA accepted its first class with women astronaut candidates. These candidates were admitted into a new category of astronaut, mission specialist. No women candidates from that first class were accepted as astronauts. According to author Tanya Lee Stone's book, Almost Astronauts, 13 Women Who Dared to Dream, the first woman in space, Valentina Tereshkova, was arguably less qualified than any of the Mercury 13, as she was not a pilot or an astronaut. Upon meeting Jerry Cobb, Tereshkova told the American she was her role model and said, "We always figured you would be the first woman in space. What happened?" For a while, it seemed that the story of the Mercury 13 ended there, but an addendum was added in 2021 when Wally Funk returned to the spotlight. She never gave up on her dream to fly in space and applied three different times in the 1970s to join NASA as a shuttle pilot. Despite her impressive credentials, she was turned down each time for not having an engineering degree or a test pilot background. In 2012, she put money down to become one of the first people to fly into space with Virgin Galactic. On July 1st, 2021, Blue Origin announced that Funk would fly on the first New Shepard flight with passengers, one of four on the flight, which included then Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, his brother Mark, and 18-year-old Oliver Damon from the Netherlands, who became the youngest person to ever fly in space. During the successful flight, which lasted 10 minutes and 18 seconds, Funk became the oldest person to fly in space at age 82, a record surpassed later that year when 90-year-old William Shatner flew on a subsequent Blue Origin flight. She is the only member of the Mercury 13 to fly in space. Today, Wally Funk lives in Grapevine, Texas, and enjoys sports and restoring antique cars with a collection that includes a 1951 Rolls-Royce Hooper Silver Wraith, the first post-World War II model Rolls. She has more than 18,600 flight hours and, as of June 2019, still flew each Saturday as an instructor. Earlier this year, she was awarded the Bob Hoover Trophy by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association for exhibiting the airmanship, leadership, mentorship, and passion for aviation that the trophy's namesake exemplified, and for having a distinguished career as a pilot and aviation advocate while also serving as a source of inspiration and encouragement for current and prospective aviators. Because a lot of the initial research and development that went into Project Gemini was completed during the same time as Project Mercury, there were far fewer unmanned launches and no test animal launches of Gemini capsules. Also, as six Americans had flown to and safely returned from space, doctors were gaining a much better idea of how spaceflight affected the human body, which began to standardize the physiological testing astronauts routinely underwent. But just because space flights were becoming more routine by the mid-1960s doesn't mean that the public and the media weren't still enthralled by humans venturing into orbit. The first of two uncrewed test flights of the Titan II rocket launched the Gemini 1 capsule into orbit on April 8th, 1964. Most of the tests during this flight were focused on the launch vehicle. Since NASA had so much trouble with the Redstone rocket before sending the Mercury 7 into space, it wanted to verify those issues had been overcome with the Titan II. 6 minutes after liftoff, the Titan II successfully put Gemini 1 into orbit where it stayed, still attached to its rocket. There was not supposed to be a separation from the capsule and the launch vehicle for this test. The planned mission was for the capsule to complete three orbits in just under 5 hours, and though the rocket had placed the capsule about 21 miles or 33.5 kilometers higher than planned, everything else worked well and the mission was deemed a success. NASA tracked the object until it re-entered the atmosphere of its own accord and disintegrated over the Atlantic after its 64th orbit 4 days later on April 12th. The second uncrewed test flight took the Gemini 2 capsule on a ballistic suborbital flight on January 19, 1965. The main purpose of this flight was to test the adequacy of the capsule's heat protection during a re-entry. Secondary objectives of the test included gathering readings on the capsule's communication, cryogenics, fuel cell, and reactant supply systems, and to further qualify the Titan II launch vehicle. This 18-minute test was mostly a success. The temperature in the cooling system was found to be too high, though not lethal, and the test results for the fuel cells weren't collected because that system failed before launch and had to be shut off. As the U.S. was nearing the crewed portion of its second-generation space capsule, the Soviets were once again looking for ways to beat them to the punch. Their plan was a huge gamble, and they took this gamble in between the two Gemini test flights. Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev knew what the U.S. was planning with Gemini and knew that having three cosmonauts orbiting over the United States would be yet another huge propaganda coup for the USSR and yet another shot to U.S. morale. There was, however, a big problem with this gamble. The Soviets did not have a three-man spacecraft, so a single-passenger Vostok capsule was converted in order to cram three crew members inside. An unmanned test flight was made on October 6, 1964, and on October 12, the riskiest manned spaceflight in history began. The modified Vostok capsule was dubbed Voskhod, which means sunrise in Russian, and had most of its stuffing removed so that it could carry three cosmonauts lying side by side. The capsule modifications meant that the crew had no ejection seats and no means to escape a launch failure. And because the three men inside took up so much of the interior, there was not room for them to wear spacesuits. They flew in tracksuits, which meant that any depressurization event would kill them. Not quite instantly, and not quite painlessly either. The Voskhod 1 crew only featured one actual cosmonaut, pilot Vladimir Komarov. The other two crew members consisted of medical doctor Boris Yegorov and Konstantin Feotistov, a space designer who had helped to reconfigure the capsule. The three were not able to do much while in space other than lay there because there was hardly room to move, but they did safely land after spending a day in space as planned. The gamble had paid off and coincided with the unconnected removal of Nikita Khrushchev from power. Soviet propaganda laid into how amazing this space achievement was to distract Soviet citizens from the political turmoil at home and to convince the West that the Soviets were still leading the space race. Though NASA and the West would have been less worried had they known about the details of the flight. As I mentioned last episode, two of the main objectives of Project Mercury were to test out orbiting capsule maneuverability and to rendezvous and dock with another orbiting object, both skills that would be essential during the Apollo program's moonshots. Project Gemini was to give NASA and its astronauts the chance to hone these skills. And before working on those skills, the plan was to have astronauts exit their capsules and perform spacewalks while attached to a tether. Naturally, the Soviets found out about that and took a spacewalk before the Americans even got their first manned Gemini capsule in orbit. Not resting on their Voskhod laurels, Soviet engineers quickly modified a few more Voskhod capsules to have an extendable airlock that would allow cosmonauts to exit and re-enter the vehicle. After a single unmanned test of the new rig ended in an in-orbit explosion, the Soviet space program said, close enough, and launched Voskhod 2 with cosmonauts Pavel Beleyev and Alexei Leonov aboard. Since the mission would include leaving the capsule, a three-person crew and tracksuits were not in the cards this time around. 30-year-old cosmonaut Alexei Leonov took the first spacewalk in human history on March 18, 1965. Because of the secrecy of the Soviet space program, few people, including Leonov's own family, knew about the walk before they watched it live on TV. In the 2004 book Two Sides of the Moon, co-written by Leonov and Apollo astronaut David Scott, the cosmonaut wrote that he felt like a seagull with its wings outstretched, soaring high above the Earth. When his four-year-old daughter Vika saw him, she hid her face in her hands and cried, "What is he doing? What is he doing? Please tell Daddy to go back inside." Leonov's elderly father was also upset. Not understanding that the entire purpose of his son's mission was to show that it was possible to survive in open space like this, he expressed his distress to the journalists gathered at his home. "Why is he acting like a juvenile delinquent?" he shouted in frustration. "Everyone else can complete their mission properly inside the spacecraft. What is he doing clamoring about outside? Somebody must tell him to get back inside immediately. He must be punished for this." His anger soon gave way to pride when he heard a live broadcast of new Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev's message of congratulations beamed up from the Kremlin via mission control. "We members of the Politburo are here sitting and watching what you are doing. We are proud of you," Brezhnev said. "We wish you success. Take care. We await your safe arrival on Earth." After about 10 minutes, Beleyev, the mission commander, called Leonov back into the capsule. As the spacewalker pulled himself back toward the airlock, his mind momentarily flashed back to his childhood, to his mother opening a window at home and calling to him as he played outside with his friends, "Lyosha, it's time to come inside now." Getting back through the airlock was easier said than done. During the spacewalk, Leonov's spacesuit had ballooned, and so to get back into Voskhod 2, he had to slowly and carefully bleed off some of the high-pressure oxygen that had accumulated in his suit via a valve in its lining. If he did this too quickly, he risked oxygen starvation. If he did this too slowly, he risked his life support system running out of its supply of fresh oxygen. In his book, Leonov recalled the process. "The only solution was to reduce the pressure in my suit by opening the pressure valve and letting out a little oxygen at a time as I tried to inch inside the airlock. At first I thought of reporting what I planned to do to Mission Control, but I decided against it. I did not want to create nervousness on the ground, and anyway, I was the only one who could bring the situation under control. But I could feel my temperature rising dangerously high with a rush of heat from my feet, traveling up my legs and arms due to the immense physical exertion all the maneuvering involved. It was taking far longer than it was supposed to. Even when I at last managed to pull myself entirely into the airlock, I had to perform another almost impossible maneuver. I had to curl my body around in order to close the airlock so Beleyev could activate the mechanism to equalize pressure between it and the spacecraft. Once the hatch was closed and the pressure equalized, Leonov scrambled back into the spacecraft, drenched in sweat, heart racing, and thankful that his re-entry into the spacecraft had not been televised for his family to see. As soon as the mission looked like it was in any sort of jeopardy, both radio and television transmission from the spacecraft going out to the general public was suspended. Leonov returning to Voskhod 2 was not the end of grave danger facing the two cosmonauts. Mere minutes before the capsule's retro rockets were set to drop it out of orbit, the cosmonauts realized that the automatic re-entry guidance system was not working correctly. They had to shut the system off and do everything else manually: orient the craft for re-entry, select their landing point on Earth, and fire the retro rockets to leave orbit. Beleyev oriented the capsule, fired the retro rockets, and began counting. The landing module was supposed to separate from the orbital module 10 seconds after the retro rockets fired, but something was very wrong. It felt as if we were being dragged back from behind, as if something was pulling us back. When we began to re-enter Earth's atmosphere, we started to feel gravity pulling us in the opposite direction. The conflicting forces, my instruments indicated 10 Gs, were so strong that some of the small blood vessels in our eyes burst. Looking out my window, I realized with horror what was happening. A communication cable connected the landing module to the orbital module, and as we rapidly entered the denser Earth atmosphere, the cable had become the two modules' common center of gravity, and we were spinning around it. The spinning eventually stopped at an altitude of about 62 miles or 100 kilometers when the connecting cable burnt through and our landing module slipped free. Then we felt a sharp jolt as first the drogue chute and then the landing parachute deployed. Everything became very peaceful, very calm. We could feel and hear the wind whistling in the straps as the module swung gently on the landing chute. Suddenly, everything became dark. We had landed in 2 meters of thick snow. The cosmonauts had come down way off course in deepest Siberia. The drama didn't end there either. They blew the escape hatch on Voshpod 2, but a birch tree held the hatch in place. They finally made it out of the capsule, and the first deep breath of cold, fresh air they took left them elated. They had survived re-entry and were safely back on Earth. Now, to be fair, safe was a relative term. Both men had grown up in the woods north of Moscow and knew that Siberia, just like their childhood exploration grounds, was full of bears and wolves. It was spring, mating season, and the time when both animals are at their most aggressive. Dodging predators, the men had no idea if Mission Control had received their rescue signal, and even if it had, how long it would take for the recovery team to reach them. It turned out that Moscow had not received the signal. In fact, Moscow was not sure whether the men had, one, re-entered yet, or two, survived re-entry. So, were Beleyev and Leonov eventually rescued? Was their single pistol enough to keep the hyper-aggressive predators at bay? Are their frozen remains still out there somewhere, trapped in the permafrost? We'll answer those questions next week. For now, it's Independence Day in the United States, and I need to fire up my barbecue, grill some hot dogs, and drink a Coke while texting my British friends and thanking them for giving me a day off from work. If you need more Ghosts of Arlington content in your life, there are photos to go along with every episode at the website www.ghostsofarlingtonpodcast.com. If you have any thoughts or comments about the show, my email address is also at the website, or you can reach out on Facebook or Twitter. Links to those sites are in the show notes. If you want to help others find out about the show, you can leave a review and 5-star rating on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, or wherever you stream from. If you really want to make my day, refer the show to a friend. And remember, fear not death, for the sooner we die, the longer we shall be immortal.